Marshall Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Basically, I kind of paraphrased David Rappaport, who's a political scientist at UCLA, who talked about these, you know, the four waves of terrorism: anarchism, anti-colonial, Marxist, and religious. And we're in the religious wave. This has gone on the longest. It's going to be the hardest to stop because, you know, the Soviet Union can go out of business, so the Marxist terrorist groups kind of faded around the same time. The anti-colonial groups actually basically got the British out of Palestine. They got the, you know, they changed the kind of British rule in Northern Ireland. They got the French out of Algeria. So those groups kind of like succeeded. So they also faded away because of success. And it's, terrorist groups don't usually succeed. Now these groups, these religious groups, I think are going to be much harder to, you know, to manage as an issue.
This is a little different, but we had a bit of a technical difficulty with today's show, so we're going to switch things up a bit and record a bit longer of an intro to cover everything that we're talking about, especially this episode. And the guest today is Peter Bergen. He is a vice president at New America and a professor at Arizona State University. Before that, though, he was one of the most extensive reporters on the life, work, and career is putting it lightly, of Osama bin Laden. You all know that we've done this long series on the war on terror and American foreign policy. There's definitely a part of the audience, despite traffic being at record highs, who's kind of wondering, when are they going to pivot back to the normal populist politics stuff? What Sagar and I wanted to talk about for a quick second is why we just feel this series, which started with General Bolger, went to Amy Chua on tribalism, then Elbridge Colby with US and China, and now to this conversation on the war on terror. It's really meant a lot to us, and we think it's really important to watch these episodes in sequence before we pivot out to our more politically focused episodes.
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, everything is downstream of what happened with 9/11 and the war on terror. It shaped everything from our response to the financial crisis, the fraying of institutional trust. I mean, the way that we conduct ourselves abroad. I think it might be hard for our younger listeners to actually really understand what it was like before 9/11. I'm just old enough to kind of remember the vibe of the 1990s, of the optimism of the dot, especially before the dot-com bubble, the information superhighway, just the sheer level of anything is possible in the post-Cold War age, and then seeing it all just come crashing down. For those of you who are born in it, I understand 100% where your cynicism and your skepticism and everything comes from. But living through that was a foremost formative experience of my entire life. And it really does shape how I view everything. So I just want to underscore that that's why we covered it so much, because it's just so important, I think, to both of us, really.
What I loved about this entire series is that it really pushed us with the audience more than we have before, as in a lot of arguments, a lot of people who said, wait, I thought you guys were anti-war, so why are you talking about the US and China? Isn't that just more imperialism? Wait, you don't think that the war started because of literal corruption? That doesn't really make any sense. So there's just all these little bits that we could push back around and rethink. And that was just the really important part here, because the best thing we could do here is I'm definitely not going to convince anyone here to hold the exact position that I have. But the number one lesson I've taken from this entire debate going back to 2001 is that ideas really matter. And the people in power, especially during the early George W. Bush administration, had really bad ideas. So if there's something we could really say to people as they look back and listen to Bolger and Amy Chua, Elbridge Colby, and then this episode of Peter Bergen in terms of actual Osama bin Laden's ideology and how he's actually approaching it, which is, how do you actually think about these things? Not the slogans, not the really obvious point, but when you're looking at a situation in Taiwan where we have hypothetical commitments, what idea do you hold about how that should be handled? And coming to a good conclusion with yourself, hopefully we could be a space where, whether you agree or disagree with us, you could find a bit here. But last but not least, Sagar, I'd love for you to give a quick take on why Peter Bergen's important and why you particularly enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, look, Peter Bergen, I grew up watching this guy on CNN. I always remember him. He was one of the first Western journalists to ever interview Osama bin Laden back in 1996. He's always kind of had his finger on the pulse. What he does a very good job of in his book, Manhunt, is telling us who the hell Bin Laden actually is. Bin Laden became this like mythologized figure, especially 2003, 2004. Bush administration wanted us all to believe that he wanted WMDs, as Peter points out in his book. Not really true. Also, though, his critiques of America were idiosyncratic. Some of them were even picked up by the new left. And the truth is that he was just like a crazy, psycho, rich Islamic fundamentalist. And there's just not much more than that. And that's actually important. Who was Osama bin Laden? That's kind of what we learned from this. A lot was projected onto him. Probably one of the most consequential figures in world history, especially of, you know, there's no question you cannot tell the history of the 21st century without the name Osama bin Laden. And yet we don't really know that much about him in our public mythos. And that's what this was about to me.
And my last main takeaway, because this was coming from Peter's book, The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden, which came out in August. The thing that really blew my mind is Peter's basic thesis here is that the US and bin Laden both did not understand each other.
Yeah.
And this is going to seem really counterintuitive. And I'm not meaning to suggest anything about what this means going forward, but funnily enough, it wasn't true that Osama bin Laden thought that by striking the US, he would bring us into these terrible forever wars. Apparently, when it looks to looking at the documentation, his actual thoughts, he thought that attacking us on September 11th was actually going to cause the US to pull further out of the Middle East. He looked at what happened in Mogadishu in Somalia, which is Black Hawk Down, for those of you who don't know the context, in 1993, when the incident and the actual battle led the US to pull out of the country. He looked at bombings in Yemen, leading to the same result. And he thought, if he wanted to achieve his number one goal of getting the US out of Saudi Arabia, launching a strike would cause the US to back down. He provoked entirely the opposite response. So that's not to say that the response we took was the right one. That's not to say that by withdrawing from Afghanistan and drawing down our presence in the Middle East, we're giving the terrorists what they want, quote unquote. That's exactly the type of bad rhetoric we're looking to avoid here. It's just to say, if we look back at history, there's this consistent lack of understanding. And I don't mean lack of understanding in the hippy dippy sense, but literally, so we're not talking empathy. Literally, Osama bin Laden did not understand the US, and he thought he did. And it led to really disastrous consequences.
Yeah, that's the same takeaway for me.
That's a perfect place to take it in. We have a Substack. You should go check it out. We also have a bookshop, which is located in our show notes. And of course, what a huge thank you to Lincoln Network. That is network of an N.
Not project.
Let's get into the episode. Hope you enjoy it. Peter Bergen, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
We've been spending the last few weeks looking at the history of the War on Terror, 20th anniversary of 9/11, discussing the future of U.S. foreign policy through the lens of competition with China and Russia. As we're nearing the end of this series, though, it's really important to take a step back and look at this entire 20-year discussion through the lens of the War on Terror specifically and through Osama bin Laden himself. So, Peter, it's really great to speak with you about him because you've recently written, among most of your writing around Osama bin Laden, a book about his specific rise and fall. And the place where I want to start, because this is really fascinating when you're looking at a story that we've been hearing about for 20 years, but there's so much that gets mixed in there. Osama bin Laden did not expect the US to behave the way it did immediately after 9/11. And the reason why I'm bringing that up, and you write this in the book, is that after the fact, he had his argument that, oh, my desire was to entrench the US in these forever wars, to drag them into the Middle East, this, and that. But that actually wasn't what he was seeking to do. So let's start there. As he was looking at the world of September 10th, looking at what happened in Mogadishu in the 1990s, Yemen, maybe Lebanon in the 1980s, what was his specific objective?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad that you've asked that question because I think it's a common misapprehension and, you know, that and sort of buying into bin Laden's post facto argument that this is all a clever plan to drag us into the Middle East. Of course, that did happen, but that was not his intent. His real intent was to push the United States out of the Middle East. And he used, you mentioned Mogadishu in 1993, after 18 American servicemen were killed, the Clinton administration pulled out of Somalia. The United States doesn't really have any interests in Somalia that are particularly pressing. Similarly, the Reagan administration pulled out of Lebanon after the Marine barracks attack in 1983. 241 American, mostly Marines, were killed. Again, the United States doesn't have super pressing interests in Lebanon. So he kind of misinterpreted all that, but he paid a lot of attention to both of these pullouts. And that was the model he wanted to use on 9/11. He thought apply enough military pressure to the United States is going to change its foreign policy in the Middle East, pull out, and then its client regimes, particularly the Saudis, will fall without American support.
Peter, what exactly, one of the things that you write in the book is that America did not understand bin Laden and bin Laden did not understand America. What did we not understand about America? What did America not understand about bin Laden? Just for a lot of our audience, some of them were not even born on 9/11. And, you know, both Marshall and I were children.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. There were two big reasons. I teach at Arizona State. And the people, the undergrads I teach, were either not alive on 9/11 or, you know, they were very small kids or babies, really. And one of my students, one of the bright students, asked me, what's the difference between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? And I thought, that's interesting. And, you know, then the Trump administration released the 470,000 files that were found in the Abbottabad, Pakistan compound where he was hiding. So that was the final, you know, they'd been released in dribs and drabs by the Obama administration. So there was a lot more primary materials to look at. But I mean, what was one of our big mistakes, I think, in terms of a misunderstanding bin Laden, when I say a lot of Americans and the Bush administration in particular, was to project on him all sorts of things that he wasn't really interested in. So the narrative after 9/11, we were attacked because of our freedoms. In fact, bin Laden replied to that rather directly. He said, if I was concerned about freedom, why didn't I attack Sweden? Which is interesting because his family, we know that 23 of the bin Laden siblings all went on holiday in Sweden. So, and bin Laden, Osama bin Laden may have been one of those kids or not. But the point is they had some real experience of what it was like to be in Sweden in the early 70s. And they're all like, there's a famous photograph, they're all wearing bell bottoms. They've all got, you know, uncovered hair and they all look like, you know, they've all got the latest hippie kind of kit. So that, you know, that the idea that it was about our freedoms. I mean, we met with him in 97 for CNN. He didn't mention anything about, you know, Hollywood tolerance or, you know, any kind of, he didn't have a cultural critique or of the United States. It was really a foreign policy critique. So I think the big first misunderstanding was trying to paint him as something that he wasn't. I'm not suggesting that that makes him better. I'm just saying that let's at least understand his motivations.
The part here, which I think is relevant for setting the tone for listeners, is can you speak to the substance of Osama bin Laden's critique of the 1990s? Because something you get at the book and you've already hinted at is that he is a person who is very media savvy and is very good at identifying topics or points to hit when he's projecting. So, for example, he'll mention climate change. I highly doubt Osama bin Laden actually woke up concerned about climate change in comparison to his broad actual concern from my interpretation, which was a U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia and the broader Middle East. So what was he actually saying? Because there's been these incidents on Twitter. I don't need you to specifically comment on the professors or their comments, where people will say things like Osama bin Laden was making this critique of 1990s hypercapitalism and all of these big, broad things. But just reading your book, it seems like this is a person who had one fundamental critique of a U.S. presence that in many ways was in opposition to his own interests in terms of wanting to serve as the protector of the faith in Saudi Arabia. What was his actual, beyond the bluster, beyond the rhetoric, what did he actually believe?
Well, you know, one of the things about bin Laden, and I try and lay it out in the book, is he was a religious zealot from an early age. And, you know, his father died when he was 10 in a plane crash. His parents divorced when he was 2. I don't do too much armchair psychologizing about it because I let the reader decide for himself or herself kind of what that all amounted to. But by his own account of his family, he turned to religion after his father's death, even though he barely knew his father. And, you know, he became a very hyper-religious teenager. So when the Prophet Muhammad died, on his deathbed, he said, let there be no two religions in Saudi Arabia. There are no churches in Saudi Arabia. There are no synagogues. Practicing any kind of religion other than Islam is sort of essentially, almost a crime. So when bin Laden saw these, hundreds of thousands of American troops go in after Saddam Hussein invade Kuwait, and then after Saddam Hussein was expelled from Kuwait, many of those troops stayed, or a good number. And he saw that as a sort of a permanent occupation by an infidel, quote unquote, force. That really was his motivation. I mean, it comes out of his religious beliefs. Hyper-capitalism, it was not something that bin Laden, he never really talked about it in any meaningful way. He had this kind of religious-based objection to American foreign policy in the Arabian Peninsula.
Yeah, it's interesting whenever I was also reading the book and getting back to what we spoke about earlier about what we didn't understand about bin Laden. I'm curious, 20 years later, bin Laden's now been dead almost 10 years. Do we still have make some of the same mistakes? So, for example, you read in the book that bin Laden did not actually favor weapons of mass destruction. He thought that it would damage al-Qaeda's brand. Bin Laden, and that isn't to say that there weren't some extremely limited instances in which they thought about it in the 1990s, but by and large, he was not considering even trying to pursue or use what the Bush administration invaded Iraq for back in 2003. Same thing whenever it came to the freedoms. Do we still have some of the same biases within the government, in the media, as analysts 20 years later, when we look at any sort of jihadist terrorism or violence? What are we getting wrong today in the same way that we were getting wrong in September 12, 2001?
In intelligence, there's a kind of classic failure, which is called mirror imaging, which is kind of the belief that everybody thinks like we do. That just isn't true. And I would say we've done some classic mirror imaging about the Taliban. I think that's going to decline based on that actual behavior. But there's been a huge amount of discussion of all the leverage we have over them, the Taliban 2.0, and surely they need all the money that we have in Afghan reserves in American banks, and surely they need international recognition and blah, blah, blah. And of course, they'd like international recognition. They'd love for $9.4 billion in reserves that are held in our banks that are of Afghan funds. But they don't really, we just have seen their new cabinet, and it's kind of striking. It's basically almost entirely Pashtun, their ethnic minority, right, that the Taliban comes from. Of course, there are no women. There are two leaders. One leader of al-Qaeda is a Taliban cabinet member of the Minister of Interior, Siraj Khani, who's described as a leader of al-Qaeda by the UN. So what were we getting wrong about the Taliban? There was just years of wishful thinking about these guys, and the whole predicate of the peace negotiations the Trump administration entered into and then that were sort of, kind of agreed to by the Biden administration is that the Taliban would have kind of separate itself from al-Qaeda. That didn't happen. That they would have real peace negotiations with the elected Afghan government. That didn't happen. And that somehow they'd be this new and improved Taliban. I was always very skeptical about that. Unfortunately, it turns out to be correct, that they are just the same. They might fiddle around the edges with some differences. For instance, when I was in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan before 9/11, television was banned and there was no internet because there was no phone service. There was nothing. The Taliban are going to allow television for their propaganda purposes. There is some independent media that's still continuing, and they may tolerate some of that, particularly if it's Western. Their main social project when it comes to women, to girls, to the way that society should be arranged, I think all that's going to be very similar.
I'm really interested to go back for a second in the discussion around Osama bin Laden believing that attacking the U.S. would elicit further withdrawal. Because as we're thinking of the lessons of history there, it's kind of counterintuitive. So I don't want to play hypotheticals too much with you. So I'm asking this more from an analytical perspective. If Osama bin Laden had believed that the U.S. would further engage in the Middle East, would actually bite back after getting struck, you could compare this to the Japanese in 1941 of Pearl Harbor making the same type of mistake. If he had known that he would elicit a more aggressive response beyond just a cruise missile, beyond just a temporary paying off of tribal forces in the north to attack him? Would he have still gone along with the plan?
It's a great what if, and I just don't know. I mean, but he made the mistake. It's a common mistake of believing his own kind of propaganda in a sense. And he really believed that the United States was weak, just like the former Soviet Union was weak. He believed that he played a key role in defeating the Soviets. That was certainly a delusional exaggeration, but nonetheless, he did fight them personally quite bravely. But his group had no impact on the course of the war, really. But he really believed that the United States was weak. And I think you rightly mentioned, I think the Japanese had the same analysis of the United States in 1941, and they kind of confuse the fact that we have this sort of raucous democracy, which has obviously got even more raucous of late. They kind of confuse that with weakness. In some ways, obviously, where we are today does make us weaker. But the point is if we get attacked by an outsider, there's a tremendous rally around the flag effect. President George W. Bush's approval ratings were 90% a week after 9/11. It's the highest, I think, rating since Gallup started rating presidents, beginning with FDR. So, he just completely misunderstood us, and it's not surprising because one thing have determined for a fact in the book is that he visited Oxford for summer school when he was 14 for 2.5 months. That was his biggest exposure to the West. He really didn't like it. He told his family, many years later, that he found the British morally degenerate, and that when he was asked to go back, he said, "I don't want to go back." So that was his full extent of exposure to the West. He also appears to have made a 2-week trip to the United States in 1979 when one of his sons needed medical treatment. So he was basing his whole analysis on a really very limited exposure to the West. He really didn't understand the West. It did not play out. I wrote a piece for CNN just in the last couple of days, or just before September 11th, and it was headlined, "Bin Laden changed history, just not in the way he expected." Right? He certainly is one of the few people that you can point to who changed history. I mean, he didn't change history on the scale of Napoleon or Hitler, but he certainly changed American foreign policy for the first two decades of the 21st century. And by extension, and also there were all these unexpected changes in the Middle East. Without 9/11, you can't really have an Iraq war because there wouldn't have been the political kind of excitement around this issue. No matter all the we all know what the Bush administration either got wrong or lied about. But without 9/11, it would have been politically impossible to send 150,000 army into Iraq to overthrow Saddam. So there were all these unexpected consequences that Bin Laden didn't know were going to happen. But 9/11, if you just look at the Middle East, the sectarianism in the Middle East was greatly increased by the Iraq war. And, one of the big changes, gentlemen, since I've been looking at this since 9/11, and I don't really get into this in the book, but I mean, what is the biggest single change in the Middle East since 9/11 is sectarianism. Hmm. Bin Laden himself was pretty careful, to his mother, it turns out, is Alawite, which is a form of Shiism, which is a heretical form of Shiism. And for Orthodox Sunnis, Shiism itself is, not Orthodox. But so Bin Laden was not interested in fomenting a sectarian war in the Middle East. Now we have that in places like Iraq and Syria and Yemen. And that's a really a new defining feature, I think, of the kind of current situation.
I want to drill down on the weakness part, because to sum up the story that I interpret you telling here, you had Osama bin Laden in the 1990s look at the fact that the Soviet Union was bled dry in Afghanistan, their version of the Vietnam War. They instantly go on to collapse for complicated reasons, but related and important reasons, and especially at a narrative level. The U.S. pulls out of Lebanon, they pull out of Yemen, pull out of Mogadishu. The weakness argument lent the story he was telling us of credibility. How do you think a budding Osama bin Laden in the year 2021, someone we've never heard of, or maybe someone we've heard of, how would they look at the U.S. and even broader Western NATO response through that lens? Because the lens could be, hey, the U.S. made these huge strategic errors. Iraq was not just a terrible idea, but a huge unforced error. Afghan pullout doesn't go in any way that's laudatory, in my opinion. But it's hard to look at this picture and think the U.S. is weak. It's hard to look at the fact, look at this picture and say, hey, the U.S. isn't willing to spend blood and treasure to enforce its vision of the world. So I just was curious how you would update the weakness analysis framework to this period.
Again, another very good question. I mean, you know, you use the phrase unforced error for Iraq, and certainly that, you know, that's a really big unforced error. And it kind of, as I say in the book, the Iraq war saved Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And then produced another iteration, which is ISIS. Now, I think another unforced error is what President Biden did in Afghanistan. And, you know, clearly no one's under the illusion, no one who's looking at this with any kind of common sense isn't aware of the fact the United States remains a superpower, capable of, you know, projecting power all over the world in ways that the Chinese still can't do. But that said, I mean, it's sort of like, there's just no way to dress up what happened on, you know, our pullout from Afghanistan as some, I mean, I've been listening to, you know, President Biden and Secretary Blinken and their defenses, and I just don't, they're not that convincing to me. I mean, I think they presented that we either had to pull out entirely, or we had to do nation building and something akin to the invasion of Normandy. Now, I'm exaggerating slightly, but I think President Obama faced the same decision, and he wanted to go to zero in Afghanistan. He left 8,400 troops there. And whether the number is 8,400 or 5,000, bear in mind that we had 7,000 allied troops from NATO that also had to pull out, and then 16,000 contractors, 6,000 American contractors. They were keeping the Afghan Air Force, you know, up in the air. That's as soon as, you know, the whole thing collapsed sort of from a psychological point of view when we announced our pullout. And wars are about the contest of will. So what will people take away from that? You know, I mean, you know, it's a paradox. We are a superpower, but we're also kind of reluctant to sometimes follow through. I think it's partly because, you know, I see all the books on your bookshelf behind you.
Yeah.
But I can see some of the titles, and we were founded. The United States was founded as an anti-empire project, and so we're kind of uncomfortable with anything that feels sort of quasi-empire-like, even if we're doing that at the invitation of the host country, as we were in Afghanistan by a duly elected government. And I think that we don't really learn the languages. We sort of always say we'll be here very temporarily. Each administration has different policies. There's no like long-term commitment. So that's all a very long way of saying. You know, on the one hand, we clearly have the ability to project power. On the other hand, you know, we've made this unforced error. And I think that President Kamala Harris or President Marco Rubio or President Joe Biden will have to reverse this, because there's a series of things that could change the political calculus here. Americans get killed in Afghanistan, a terrorist attack against American interests in the region, the Taliban engage in ethnic cleansing, which they did when they were in power. Lots of things could sort of trigger a change in policy. So I don't think the Taliban are going to be there forever, because they're going to do something stupid. They're either going to allow. Go ahead.
No, well, see, this is the interesting. I mean, I'll be honest, I was an open supporter of the Biden policy, of the Trump policy, too. And I just look at the current look, you've been at this a lot longer than me. I literally grew up watching you on TV. So that being said. What I see is the Taliban in its current form, I agree with you, ideologically is not different. But also, wouldn't they be the biggest idiots on the planet in order to allow another Al-Qaeda 9/11-based plot, which, as you write in your book, it's not like Mullah Omar and the Taliban and all these people were big supporters of bin Laden. They thought he was a pain in the ass. They saw Al-Qaeda as this kind of like clownish project, but also like Pashtunwali guest code requires them to give him, you know, safe haven. Like, would they really allow that in order to happen? Like, I've lived in Qatar. I've lived around Wahhabist Muslims. Yeah. Like, they're also rational beings. So I'm just like, I have a very hard time believing they would allow that to happen again.
But they did before, you know. I mean, they didn't expel bin Laden after the embassy attacks in Africa, which killed 212.
Right.
Most and a lot, many Muslim civilians, because Kenya and Tanzania have large minority Muslim populations, and so you know, they look. We had The new spokesman of the Taliban, who is now in the cabinet, publicly said just 2 weeks ago that Bin Laden, there's no evidence Bin Laden was involved in 9/11. So it's like, I mean, it's just like, that's what they said 20 years ago. And then you've got Siraj Akhani, who's the Minister of the Interior, who is described by the United Nations, not by me, as a leader of Al-Qaeda, on the leadership council of Al-Qaeda. So, yep, you know, I think another case of mirror imaging is the assumption that everybody is going to behave rationally. I think history suggests that that is not true. I'm a student of history, and I have a kind of rather tragic view of like what actually happens. People do dumb things all the time. They make mistakes. They do things that are not rational. And that's actually human beings. I mean, that's a good description of us. Sure. So yeah, from a sort of rational actor thing for perspective, they would be mad to let Al-Qaeda regroup and carry out some attack. No, I mean, they're not capable of doing a 9/11 attack on the United States because our defenses are so much better. But are they capable of kind of attacking an American, you know, let's say an American embassy, right, in the region or something like that?
Hotel or something like that.
Sure. Yeah, the hotel. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was really interested in first person isn't the right way to describe your writing style, but you really brought in Osama bin Laden's writing and correspondence on how devastating the drone policy was, especially post 2008. And we don't really talk about drones in our public discourse as much, but I just remember as someone who was in college during the Obama era, there was a large amount of discussion on whether the drone strike policy was inhumane, civilian casualties, these broader points. But it's hard to look at what happened during that post 2008 period and not conclude we seem to have found a way around the dilemma of a broad boots on the ground engagement in the country, which is that we can use these technologies to effectively deny any freedom of movement or of action to any terrorist groups in those sorts of regions. How do you think, disagree, agree with my assessment, but also how does that play into how we're thinking of the terrorism question moving forward?
I mean, I'm totally in agreement with you. I mean, and the person who's also in agreement with you is Osama bin Laden, because we know from the documents that I used in the book. I mean, he was extremely concerned about the drone program. It was killing every number three in Al-Qaeda, many leaders of Al-Qaeda. He was so concerned about it that he was planning to move the group out of the tribal regions on the Afghan-Pakistan border where all the drone strikes were being concentrated. You know, he was telling his family to only move on cloudy days if they were in the tribal regions in Pakistan, only to meet in tunnels. So, I mean, the best witness for the effectiveness of the drone program has been Bin Laden himself. So, yeah, and presidents as different as President George W. Bush, President Barack Obama, who was really the drone president. I mean, Pakistan, you mentioned you were in college, and this, like, you know, there were 122 drone strikes in Pakistan in 2010, ordered by President Obama. It's the largest number of drone strikes in Pakistan. So, I mean, there were definitely, you know, there were a lot of Pakistanis who were angry about it, not just on the issue of civilian casualties, which over time really dropped off, but, you know, the infringement of national sovereignty is a big issue. And a very, you know, do the thought experiment where there was a group of Mexican drug cartel in Texas, and Mexico was, you know, launching drone strikes that were very effective in taking out this cartel, but also were infringing Texan sovereignty. I mean, people would be pissed off, and that's really what happened here. But that, be that as it may, you know, Presidents George W. Bush, President Barack Obama, President Trump, and President Biden has also authorized some strikes in Afghanistan against ISIS-K, as you know, and then also in Somalia. He's largely stopped the program, but he hasn't stopped it entirely. So there's a lot of bipartisan consensus around the program for the reason you suggest, which is, you know, no boots on the ground. The civilian casualty rate has really gone down a fair amount over time. You know, they're effective. It's not like a magic bullet, but it's pretty effective.
Yeah. I mean, that is something that people have to grapple with, which is like, I was reading your book and I was like, wow, he was scared as hell as the drone program. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said in the discourse of like, oh, well, it inspires more terrorists. Maybe. But I mean, bin Laden himself is somebody who's straight up like, this is really bad and is destroying the Al-Qaeda network. So I'm like,
yeah.
Primary source.
Yeah.
I'm curious, one thing, as it's kind of hilarious, is that bin Laden becomes increasingly relevant to his own story as you go on in the book. So like 9/11 actually is the apex of his power in terms of his ability to operate in Afghanistan. Then he has to go into hiding. Then he becomes so terrified of getting arrested, he cuts himself off from the entire Al-Qaeda network except outside of letters. He becomes just like a micromanaging boss who's specifically telling people what to say and not say in Yemen and Iraq. Increasingly, Zarqawi, who becomes who is the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, doesn't really care what he has to say and basically takes jihad to a whole new level and ignites this sectarian warfare. And the funniest part to me was how he created these like Potemkin village sessions where he was like this all-important sheikh as his family interviewed him near the end of his life, where they were like collectively writing this biography. You could just kind of see his narcissism. But I'm curious, like, when you look at that, Bin Laden, as he increasingly becomes less relevant to the overall, you know, jihad and more, how is it seen today? Like, as in today, how do people who are terrorists, how do they look at Bin Laden? Do they even remember him? As in, like, did he do this, and was he the father of the whole movement, or was he just merely a participant?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, you look at polling data. Bin Laden had very high favorability ratings, relatively speaking, around the Muslim world shortly after 9/11. But those sort of dissipated over time, and they correlate with lack of support for suicide attacks, because so many of these attacks were killing Muslim civilians. So,
right.
I think, you know, and Bin Laden, I think he sort of faded from history to, you know, to sort of relevance. I mean, his big idea, the United States is behind all the problems in the Muslim world, I think that idea still exists. And ISIS, even though it's in a split with Al-Qaeda right now, you know, which is partly about personalities as much as principles, you know, they continue to see Bin Laden as a inspirational figure. So I think in the jihadist movement, he's still like number one. People sometimes say, is there somebody that could replace him? You mentioned, like, if there was a young Bin Laden today, you know, kind of, you know, but I don't see that person. Ayman al-Zawahiri, we just heard from on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, he may be ill. He's certainly out of it. He certainly hasn't led the organization. He hasn't reformed it in any meaningful way. But now it does have a new platform in Afghanistan. And United Nations talks about thousands of foreign fighters from Central Asia and Pakistan flooding in. This is before the Taliban completely took over the country. Every jihadist group is going to find a sympathetic base there. Al-Qaeda means the base in Arabic. They've got a new one in Afghanistan. We've seen the movie play out before. It's probably going to play out in very similar ways, where some people in the West will get inspired by the new emirate, will carry out attacks in the name of the emirate. Some people, let's say from Europe, will manage to get to Afghanistan, get training, come back. We in the United States are somewhat, you know, we're protected by two oceans. And to some degree also by the American dream, which has kind of worked pretty well for American Muslims, and therefore they're much better integrated into American society than is the case in, say, France, or, you know, second generation French Muslims you know, discriminated against, and, you know, their incomes are much lower and they're living in effectively ghettos, and, you know, that's a whole different story. But the point is that we've been here before, and we were here before 9/11. We were here in summer of 2014 in Iraq when ISIS took over much of it, Iraq and Syria. And I don't see why there would be a significant difference this time around.
The real question then for me is, what does this current state of affairs effectively mean for the broader set of ideas that Osama was advancing, in the sense that the critical case is Muslims, we need to strike back. We've alluded to this, but the U.S. is weak. You could get a knockout blow. But that event doesn't really happen. So I'm curious, how do you think let's keep referencing this hypothetical future Osama bin Laden, how would they look at the past 20 years and think about the intellectual side? Because the key thing, this is why I really enjoy the book, I'd say the first fourth, it's really centered around these ideas that he had. Like, he really did conceive of himself not merely as a tactician, but he had a framework, he had an approach. What do we know from maybe captured documents or public statements? What is the current intellectual framework that an Al-Qaeda-aligned person would hold right now looking at this wreckage?
Well, I mean, they, in their minds, these, the, let's say looking at the broader jihadi movement, you know, they had, if I now had three great victories, one is pushing the Soviets out of Afghanistan, two is 9/11, three is pushing the Americans out of Afghanistan. And, you know, obviously, as, you know, we're talking about a movement, I don't know what the exact number is, but let's throw out a number of 200,000 people who basically share this ideology and may have some kind of training all around the world. You know, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the number of Muslims in the world, but, you know, it's nonetheless not an insignificant figure when you look at it. And so I think their narrative, which is not shared by, you know, 99.9% of Muslims, is, you know, violence against the United States is a good thing. The United States is responsible for the ills of the Muslim world. Let's throw in the Shia as a problem too, because the Taliban and ISIS tend to want to attack Shia targets in Afghanistan. And we've seen, I mentioned earlier, you know, this kind of rise of sectarianism, which has become much more profound. So the new bin Laden would be, you know, anti, you know, very anti-Shia. And he also would be, you know, still anti-American. Maybe he'd be less focused on the idea of attacking the United States itself, and maybe he'd be more focused on trying to overthrow the government of, let's say, Somalia or Yemen, or pick your country with a weak and, or, you know, failing state. And that, you know, I'm not saying this is a coherent ideology. I'm just saying this is the ideology they have.
Mm-hmm. So we want to pivot to your most recent book, because the question of how the war on terror and all the ideas we're talking about actually influence the U.S. military, especially at the general level, is important. But the last question I'll ask you, and you alluded to this at the end of the book, you referenced Leon Czolgosz, who was the, I think, Polish immigrant who assassinated President McKinley in the name of anarchism at the end of the 19th century. And the reason why that resonated is you're referencing it in the context of there are these moments where something really means something. The death of McKinley, the elevation of Theodore Roosevelt, that all is deeply important. Anarchism, huge deal. All sorts of domestic terrorism, all sorts of bombings, deaths, et cetera, et cetera. Yet no one remembers Leon Czolgosz. No one thinks of anarchism beyond at a literally joking level. So can you just expand on what you were alluding to between the tie between Leon Czolgosz and the 19th to 20th century transition, and then maybe even Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and whether a century from now people are going to be podcasting, making essentially the same point? That's just what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
and the last thing, because Hitler still matters. Like whenever we will always talk about World War II in the context of Hitler. Yeah. We don't do the same with Czolgosz, and maybe not with bin Laden.
Well, you know, I mean, I think, yeah. So I didn't even know who Czolgosz was. I didn't know McKinley was assassinated. So that your point is well taken. You know, basically, I kind of paraphrased David Rappaport, who's a political scientist at UCLA, who talked about these, you know, the four waves of terrorism: anarchism, anti-colonial, Marxist, and religious. And we're in the religious wave. This has gone on the longest. It's going to be the hardest to stop because, you know, the Soviet Union can go out of business. So the Marxist terrorist groups kind of faded around the same time. The anti-colonial groups actually basically got the British out of Palestine. They changed the kind of British rule in Northern Ireland. They got the French out of Algeria. So those groups kind of like succeeded. So they also faded away because of success. And it's, terrorist groups don't usually succeed. Now, these groups, these religious groups, I think are going to be much harder to extirpate or manage or whatever. I mean, extirpate is too strong a word, because there's always going to be people with these ideas. But, you know, to manage as an issue. And I think, you know, they just got a new lease of life with the Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, this very hardline government that includes essentially a leader of Al-Qaeda. So I think that this will go on. It won't be like a Trivial Pursuit question like the who killed President McKinley in 1901. And it obviously won't be Adolf Hitler, who, you know, as a result of, you know, tens of millions of people died in Europe and, Western civilization was at stake. So, you know, will it be closer to the President McKinley assassin? Yeah, probably. And I end the book with Gina Bennett, who was the first American official to she asked sort of a version of the same, she was talking about a version of the same question, which is Gina Bennett was the first person to write a warning about bin Laden back in 93, and she's still at the CIA today. And one of the junior analysts was tremendously excited when, you know, bin Laden was killed. And she said, do you know who the Baader-Meinhof gang is? And the junior analyst said, I don't. Now, back in the 1970s, Baader-Meinhof was almost a household name because they were killing very prominent German businessmen and politicians. And, you know, they were a big deal. And they now they are a Trivial Pursuit question. So I think, you know, I think it's the right question. I think it's the right question to ask. But I don't think bin Laden's ever going to be a trivial issue. Gina says, like, you know, the worst day for these guys are bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, is when I when a somebody at the counterterrorism center at CIA doesn't even know who bin Laden is. I think that's a long way off. But if you, you know, maybe a century from now, Marshall, it will be something, you know, it will be seen as sort of, you know, it, like a minor blip in the bigger scheme of things. But it's hard for me, right? You know, I lived through 9/11. I was, you know, I was an adult, and you know, that was a big event in American, you know, the psyche of the United States, because we'd taken a long holiday from history in the 90s, right? I mean, we'd won the Cold War, we had this huge stock market run up at Bill Clinton's, you know, presided over it was the most prosperous moment in American history up to that point. And then you had this attack. And so that brought us back into history. And a lot of history was created as a result. So I think it's hard to imagine a situation where, you know, bin Laden's going to be a Trivial Pursuit question, even you know, a century from now.
I said we were going to move on, but I have to do a quick follow-up to that, because we have actually a decent, more left-leaning audience who are screaming into their phones for someone to ask this question. You said the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which I frankly oppose to say my own biases, actually could have given a new lease on life to broader jihadist terrorism. But can it be argued that continued presence in the country actually gave force and gave meaning to jihadist terrorism, in the sense that if you look at what Osama bin Laden is claiming in the 1990s, he's claiming US is where it shouldn't be, it's invading Muslim countries. Therefore, can you just square those circles? Because yeah, that's, I mean, the part that's difficult.
I mean, we were there at the invitation of the Afghan government, the elected Afghan government. The Taliban hasn't been elected to dog catcher, as far as I know. They've never engaged in any. So, you know, as flawed as the Afghan elections were, they were real elections, particularly in Afghan. I mean, the first election that I witnessed in 2004, there was a 70% turnout. There hasn't been a 70% turnout in an American election since, I think, 1900. So there was a lot of excitement around this.
Everyone,
I mean,
look,
Occupying Afghanistan. We were there at the invitation of the Afghan government.
We had to actually cut the interview there.
And we had a 3,500 troop presence.
Books, so be sure to,
you know, in Afghanistan, everything he's, you know, we have a 25,000 troop presence in South Korea. We're at the invitation of the South Korean government as well. And so, you know, who suffered the most from jihadist terrorism? The Afghans. I mean, 66,000 of their soldiers died fighting the Taliban. There's been a narrative they didn't fight. Well, they didn't fight when they knew the war was lost. And they've had 43 years of war, and they all want to keep their heads on their bodies. And so it's not that they were weak or bad people. They saw which way things were going, and they surrendered because they wanted to live. And this is like the, you know, this, no country's had a Soviet occupation, a communist government, the civil war, the Taliban, and the American invasion, and then, you know, this Afghan government. You know, this is kind of like an Afghan my age, I'm 58, would have been 15 at the beginning of the civil war. You know, people want to survive, and there's nothing wrong with that. And they know, anybody my age also know what the Taliban are capable of. And, you know, they're going to impose a theocratic law and order regime that is going to be pretty unpleasant.
Everyone, especially if you are listening to the audio version of this, we had a bit of connectivity issues toward the end. So if it seems like there's a hard cut here, we had to actually cut the interview there. Peter Berger was a great guest. We really appreciate his books. So be sure to check out everything he's working on there. Reminder, Substack subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.